This is tape 7 of John Howie's Biographia Scoticana, or The Scots Worthies, the 1781 edition, narrated by Larry Berger, Jr., with assistance from Lynn Hopewell. This work is available from Stillwater's Revival Books, along with a treasure trove of the finest Protestant, Reformed, and Puritan literature available anywhere in the world today. Stillwater's may be reached at area code 780-450-3730, or be emailed at swrb@swrb.com. Stillwater's website is www.swrb.com and contains numerous free books and articles. Please note that these tapes are not copyrighted. We therefore encourage you to copy and distribute them to any and all you believe would be benefited. We continue our reading with the life of Mr. David Calderwood. Mr. David Calderwood, having spent some time in the grammar school, went to the university to study theology in order for the ministry, where after a short space, being found fit for the office, he was made minister at Crelling near Jedburgh, where for some considerable time he preached the word of God with great wisdom, zeal, and diligence, and as a faithful wife harvest man, brought in many sheaves into God's granary. But it being then a time when prelacy was upon the advance in the church, and faithful ministers were everywhere thrust out and suppressed, he, among the rest, gave his declinature in the year 1608, and thereupon took instruments in the hands of James Johnson, notary public, in presence of some of the magistrates and council of the town, whereupon information being sent to the king by the bishops, a direction was sent from him to the council to punish him, and another minister, who declined, exemplarily. But by the earnest dealing of the Lord of Lothian with the chancellor in favors of Mr. Calderwood, their punishment resolved only to be a confinement within their own parish, and so forth. Here he continued until June 1617, that he was summoned to appear before the High Commission Court at St. Andrews upon the 8th of July following. Being called upon, the king being present, and his libel read and answered, the king among others said, "What moved you to protest?" "An article concluded among the lords of the articles," Mr. David answered. "But what fault was there in it?" said the lord. "It cutteth off our general assemblies," answered Mr. Calderwood. The king, having the protestation in his hand, challenged him for some words of the last clause thereof. He answered, "Whatsoever was the phrase of speech, they meant no other thing but to protest, that they should give passive obedience to his majesty, but could not give active obedience unto any unlawful thing that should flow from that article." "Active and passive obedience," said the king. "That is, we shall suffer, then practice," said Mr. David. "I will tell thee," said the king, "what is obedience, man. What the centurion said to his servant, 'To this man go, and he goeth, and to that man come, and he cometh,' that is obedience." He answered, "To suffer, sir, is also obedience, albeit not of the same kind, and that obedience was not absolute, but limited with exception of a countermand from a superior power. I am informed," said the king, "ye are a refractor, and the bishop of Glasgow your ordinary, and the bishop of Caithness the moderator in your presbytery, testify that you have kept no order. You have repaired to neither presbytery nor synod, and are no way conform." He answered, "I have been confined these 8 or 9 years to my conformity and nonconformity, and that point could not well be known." "Good faith, thou art a very knave," said the king. "See these same false Puritans, they are ever playing with equivocations." The king asked, "If he was relaxed, would he obey or not?" He answered, "I am wronged, in that I am forced to answer such questions, which are beside the libel," and so forth, after which he was removed. When called in again, it was intimated to him that if he did not repair to synods and presbyteries between this and October, conform in the time, and promise obedience in all time coming, the Bishop of Glasgow was to deprive him. Then Mr. David begged to leave to speak to the bishops, which being granted, he reasoned thus, "Neither can ye suspend or deprive me in this court of high commission, for ye have no power in this court, but by commission from his majesty cannot communicate that power to you, which he claims not to himself." At which the king wagged his tail and said to him, "Are there not bishops and fathers in the church and so forth, persons clothed with power and authority to suspend and oppose?" "Not in this court," answered Mr. Calderwood. At which word there arose a confused noise, so that he was obliged to extend his voice that he might be heard. In the end, the king asked him if he would obey the sentence, to which he answered, "Your sentence is not the sentence of the kirk, but a sentence null in itself, and therefore I cannot obey it." At which, some reviling him as a proud knave, others were not ashamed to shake his shoulder in a most insolent manner, till at last he was removed a second time. Being again called in, the sentence of deprivation was pronounced. He was ordained to be committed to close ward in the toll booth at St. Andrew's. Till afterward that farther orders would be taken for his banishment, after which he was upbraided by the bishops, who said that he deserved to be used as Ogilvy the Jesuit, who was hanged. When he would have answered, the bishops would not allow him, and the king in a rage cried, "Away with him!" And Lord Scone took him by the arm and led him out, where they stayed some time, waiting for the bailiffs of the town. In the meantime, Mr. Calderwood said to Scone, "My lord, this is not the first like turn of the hath fallen into your hands." "I must serve the king," said Scone, and to some ministers then standing by, he said, "Brethren, ye have Christ's cause in hand at this meeting. Be not terrified with the spectacle. Prove faithful servants to your master." Scone took him to his house till the keys of the toll booth were had. "By the way," one demanded, "whither the man, my lord?" "First to the toll booth, and then to the gallows," said Scone. He was committed close prisoner, and the same afternoon a charge was given to transport him to the jail of Edinburgh. After the charge, he was delivered to two of the guard to be transferred thither, although several offered to bail him, that he might not go out of the country. But no order of council could be had for that end, for the king had a design to keep him in close ward till the ship was ready to convey him first to London and then to Virginia. But Providence had ordered otherwise, for upon several petitions in his behalf, he was liberated out of the prison upon Lord Cranston's being bail that he should depart out of the country. After this, Mr. Calderwood went with Lord Cranston to the king at Carlisle, where the said lord presented a petition to him that Mr. David might only be confined to his parish. But the lord inveighed against him so much that at last he repulsed Cranston with his elbow, insisted again for prorogation of time for his departure till the last of April because of the winter season, that he might have leisure to get up his year's stipend. The king answered, howbeit he begged, it were no matter. He would know himself better the next time, and for the season of the year, if he drowned in the seas, he might thank God that he had escaped a worse death. Yet Cranston being so importunate for the prorogation, the king answered, I will advise with my bishops. Thus the time was delayed until the year 1619, that he wrote a book called Perth Assembly, which was condemned by the council in the month of December of that same year. But as he himself says, neither the book nor the author could be found, for in the month of August preceding, he had embarked for Holland. During his abode there, one Patrick Scott, a landed gentleman near Falkland, having wasted his patrimony, had no other means to recover his state but by some unlawful shift at court, and for that end, in the year 1624, he set forth a recantation under the name of a banished minister, that is, Mr. David Calderwell, who, because of his long sickness before, was supposed to have been dead. The king, as he alleged to some of his friends, furnished him with the matter, and he set it down in form. This project failing, he went over to Holland and sought Mr. Calderwood in several towns, particularly in Amsterdam in the month of November, in order to dispatch him, as afterwards appeared. After he had stayed 20 days in Amsterdam, making all the search he could, he was informed that Mr. Calderwood had returned home privately to his own native country, which frustrated his intention. After the death of King James, he put out a pamphlet full of this, entitled Vox Vera, and yet notwithstanding of all of this wicked and unlawful pursuits, he died soon after, so poor he had not wherewith to defray the charges of his funeral. Mr. Calderwood, being now returned home after the death of King James, remained in private as possible, and was mostly at Edinburgh, where he strengthened the hands of nonconformists, being also a great opposer of sectarianism, until after the year 1638 that he was admitted minister at Pankitland in East Lothian. He contributed very much to the coveted work carried on in that period, for first he had an active hand in drawing up several excellent papers, wherein were contained the records of church policy betwixt the years 1576 and 1596, which were presented and read by Mr. Johnston, the clerk at the General Assembly at Glasgow, in the year 1638. And also, by recommendation of the General Assembly, 1646, he was ordered to consider the order of the visitation of kirks and trials of presbyteries, and to report thereof unto the General Assembly. Likewise, at the General Assembly, 1648, a further recommendation was given him to draw a draught of the form of visitation of particular congregations against the next assembly, and was also one of those appointed with Mr. David Dixon to draw up the form of the directory for the public worship of God by the General Assembly, 1643. After he had both spent and been spent with the apostle for the cause and interest of Jesus Christ, when the English army lay at Lothian in the year 1651, He went to Jedburgh, where he sickened and died in a good old age. He was another valiant champion for the truth, who, in pleading for the crown and interest of Jesus Christ, knew not what it was to be daunted by the face and frowns of the highest and most incensed adversaries. Before he went to Holland, he wrote the book entitled Perth Assembly. While in Holland, he wrote the learned book called Altera Damascenum, which some other pieces in English, which contribute somewhat to keep many straight in the declining period. After his return, he wrote the history of our church as far down as the year 1625, of which the printed copy that we have is only a short abstract of the large written history, which, both as to the style and the manner wherein is to be executed, is far preferable to the printed copy. And whoever compares the two, or the last, with his Altera Damascenum, both of which are yet in the hands of some, will readily grant the truth of this assertion. And yet all this derogates nothing from the truth of the facts reported in the printed copy. Therefore, no offense needs to be taken out of the information that there is a more full and better copy than what is yet extant. See the note on the 78th page of Mr. Livingston's Life and Memorable Characteristics, and so forth. The Life of Mr. Hugh Binning. He was son to John Binning of Delnan, and Margaret McKell, daughter of Mr. Matthew McKell, minister at Bothwell, and sister to Mr. Hugh McKell, one of the ministers at Edinburgh. His father's worldly circumstances were so good, being possessed of no inconsiderable estate in the Shire of Ayr, that he was enabled to give his son Hugh a very liberal education, the good effects of which were appeared very early upon him. For the greatness of his spirit and capacity of a judgment gave his parents good grounds to conceive the pleasing hopes of his being a promising child. When he was at the grammar school, he made so great proficiency in the knowledge of the Latin tongue and the Roman authors that he outstripped his fellow scholars, even such as were some years older than himself. When they went to the diversion, he declined their society and chose to employ himself either in secret duty with God or conference with religious people, thinking time was too precious to be lavished away in these things. He began to have sweet familiarity with God and to live in near communion with Him before others began seriously to lay heart their lost and undone state and conditions by nature, and so forth, so that before he arrived at the 13th or 14th year of his age, he had even attained to such experience in the way of God that most judicious and exercised Christians in the place confessed they were much edified, strengthened, and comforted by him, nay, that he provoked them to diligence in the duties of religion, being abundantly sensible that they were much outrun by such a youth. Before he was 14 years of age, he entered upon the study of philosophy in the University of Glasgow, wherein he made a very considerable progress, by which means he came to be taken notice of in the college by the professors and students, and at the same time he advanced remarkably in religion also. The obtuse depths of philosophy, which are the torture of slow genius and a weak capacity, he dived into without any pain or trouble, so that by his ready apprehension of things he was able to do more in 1 hour than others could do in many days by hard study and close application. And yet he was ever humble, and never exalted with self-conceit, the common foible of young men. As soon as his course of philosophy was finished, he commenced Master of Arts with great applause. He began the study of divinity with a view to serve God in the holy ministry, at which time there happened to be a vacancy in the College of Glasgow by the resignation of Mr. James Dalrymple of Stair, who had sometime been his master. And though Mr. Binning was but lately his scholar, yet he was determined, after much entreaty, to stand as a candidate for that post. There's a footnote concerning Mr. Dalrymple I'd like to share with you. This gentleman entered advocate in the year 1648, and was by the Protector made one of the judges of the session in the year 1657, and became president in the year 1681. In the year 1682, he had to retire to Holland. In 1689, he was restored to his office, and in 1690 was created a viscount. He wrote the Institutions of the Law of Scotland, and also published a system of physic greatly valued at the time, with a book entitled A Vindication of the Divine Attributes, in which there is discovered great force of argument and sound knowledge. We return to the text. According to the usual landable custom, the masters of the college emitted a program and sent it to all the universities of the kingdom, inviting such as had a mind for a profession of philosophy to sit themselves before them and offer themselves to compete for the preferment, giving assurance that without partiality the place should be conferred upon him who should be found ignor et doctor. the ministers of the city of Glasgow, considering how much it was the interest of the church that a well-qualified person be put into the profession of philosophy and so forth, and knowing that Mr. Binning was eminently pious and of a bright genius as well as solid judgment, set upon him to list himself among the other competitors, but they had difficulty to overcome his modesty. They at last prevailed upon him to declare his willingness to undertake the dispute before the masters. Among others, there were other two candidates, one of whom had the advantage of a great interest with Dr. Stang, principal at the college at the time, and the other a scholar of great abilities. Yet Mr. Binning so managed the dispute and acquitted himself in all parts of his trial that to the conviction of the judges he darkened his rivals. But the doctor and some of the faculty who joined him, though they could not pretend the person they inclined to prefer had an equality, much less a superiority in the dispute, yet they argued, cateris paribus, that this person, they intended, was a citizen's son, of a competency of learning, and a person of more years, and by that means had greater experience than what Mr. Binning, who was in the manner but of yesterday, could suppose to have. But to this it was replied, that Mr. Binning was such a pregnant scholar, so wise and sedate as to be above all the follies and vanities of youth, and what was wanting in years was made up sufficiently by his more than ordinary and singular endowments. Whereupon a member of the faculty, perceiving the struggle to be great, as indeed there were plausible reasons on both sides, proposed a dispute between the two candidates extempore upon any subject that they should be pleased to prescribe. This being considered, soon put a period to the division amongst them, those who would have opposed him not being willing to engage their friend with such an able antagonist a second time. Mr. Binning was elected. Mr. Binning was not quite 19 years of age when he commenced regent and professor of philosophy, and though he had not time to prepare a system of any part of his profession, as he had instantly to begin his class, yet such was the quickness and fertility of his invention, and the tenaciousness of his memory, and the solidity of his judgment, that his dictates to his scholars had a depth of learning and perspicuity of expression, and was among the first in Scotland that began to reform philosophy from the barbarous terms and unintelligible jargon of the schoolmen. He continued in his profession 3 years and discharged his trust so as to gain the general applause of the university for academical exercises. And this was the more remarkable that having turned his thoughts toward the ministry, he carried on his theological studies at the same time and made great improvements therein, for his memory was so retentive that he scarcely forgot anything he had heard or read. It was easy and ordinary for him to transcribe any sermon after he had returned to his chamber at such a length that the intelligent and judicious reader who had heard it preached would not find one sentence wanting. During this period he gave full proof of his progress in knowledge and divinity by a composition from 2 Corinthians chapter 5, verse 14, "For the love of Christ constraineth us," etc., which performance he sent to a gentlewoman who had been some time in Edinburgh for her private edification, who, having perused the same, judged it to have been a sermon of some eminent minister in the west of Scotland, and put it into the hands of the then provost of Edinburgh, who judged it of the same manner. But when she returned to Glasgow, she found her mistake by Mr. Binning's asking it at her. This was the first discovery he had given of his dexterity and abilities in explaining the scripture. At the expiration of 3 years as a professor of philosophy, the parish of Govan, which lies adjacent to the city of Glasgow, happened to be vacant, and before this, whoever was principal of the College of Glasgow was also minister there. But this being attended with inconveniences, an alteration was made, and the presbytery, having a view to supply the vacancy with Mr. Binning, they took him upon trials in order to be licensed a preacher. And preaching there to the great satisfaction of that people, he was some time after called to be minister of that parish, which call the presbytery approved of, and entered him upon trials for ordination about the 22nd year of his age, and went through them to the unanimous approbation of the presbytery, giving their testimony of his fitness to be one of the ministers of the city upon the first vacancy, having a view at the same time to bring him back to the university whenever the profession of divinity should be vacant. He was, considering his age, a prodigy of learning, for before he had arrived at the 26th year of his life, he had such a large stock of useful knowledge as to be philologus, philosophus, et theologus, eximius, and might well have been an ornament to the most famous and flourishing university in Europe. This was the more surprising, considering his weakness and infirmity of body, as not being able to read much at a time, and to undergo the fatigue of continual study, insomuch that his knowledge seemed rather to have been born with him than to have been acquired by hard and laborious study. Though he was bookish and much intent upon the fulfilling of his ministry, yet he turned his thoughts to marriage and did espouse a virtuous and excellent person, Mrs. Barbara Simpson, daughter of Mr. James Simpson, a minister in Ireland. Upon the day he was to be married, he went accompanied with his friend and some others, among whom were several worthy ministers, into an adjacent country congregation upon the day of their weekly sermon. The minister of the parish delayed sermon till they would come, hoping to put the work upon one of the ministers whom he expected to be there. But all declining it, he tried next to prevail on the bridegroom, with whom he succeeded, though the invitation was not expected. It was no difficult task to him to preach upon short warning. He stepped aside a little to premeditate and implore his master's presence and assistance, for he was ever afraid to be alone in this work, and entered the pulpit immediately, and preached upon 1 Peter chapter 1, verse 15, "But as he that hath called you is holy," etc. At which time he was so remarkably helped that all acknowledged that God was with him of a truth. When the unhappy differences betwixt the resolutioners and protesters fell out, among them Mr. Billing was the last denomination, this distinction proved to be of fatal consequence. He saw some of the evils of it in his own time, and being of a Catholic and healing spirit, with a view to the cementing of differences, he wrote an excellent treatise of Christian love, which contains very strong and pathetic passages most opposite to the subject. He was no fomenter of factions, but studious of the public tranquility. He was a man of moderate principles and temperate passions, never imposing or overbearing upon others, but willingly hearkened to advice, and always yielded to reason. The prevailing of the English sectarians under Oliver Cromwell to the overthrow of the Presbyterian interest in England, and the various attempts which they made in Scotland in the constitution and discipline of this church, was one of the greatest difficulties which the ministers had then to struggle with. Upon this he hath many excellent reflections in his sermons, particularly in that sermon from Deuteronomy 32, verses 4 and 5. After he had labored 4 years in the ministry, serving God with his spirit in the gospel of his Son, he died in the year 1653 of consumption, when he was scarce come to the prime and vigor of his life, being only in this 26th year of his age, leaving behind him a sweet savor and epistle of commendation upon the hearts of those who were his hearers. He was a person of singular piety, of a humble, meek, and peaceable temper, a judicious and lively preacher, nay, so extraordinary a person that he was justly counted a prodigy of human learning and knowledge of divinity. From his childhood he knew the Scriptures, and from a boy had been much under deep and spiritual exercise, until the time, or a little before, that he entered upon the office of the ministry, when he came to a great calm and tranquility of mind, being mercifully relieved from all these doubtings, which for a long time he had been exercised with. And though he studied in his discourses to condescend to the capacity of the meaner sort of hearers, yet it must be owned that his gift of preaching was not so much accommodated to a country congregation as it was to the judicious and learned. Mr. Binning's method was peculiar to himself, much after the haranguing way. He was no stranger to the rules of art, and knew well how to make his matter subservient to the subject he handled. His diction and language was easy and fluent, void of all affectation and bombast. It was a kind of undesigned, negligent elegance which arrests the reader's attention. Considering the time he lived in, it might be said that he carried the orator's prize from his contemporaries in Scotland, and was not at the time inferior to the best pulpit orator in England. While he lived, he was highly esteemed, having been a successful instrument of saving himself and them that heard him, of turning sinners into righteousness, and of perfecting the saints. He died much lamented by all good people who had the opportunity of knowing him. The great divine Mr. James Durham gave him this verdict, quote, "that there was no speaking after Mr. Binning," unquote. And truly he had the tongue of the learned, and knew how to speak a word in season. Besides his works, which are bound up in quarto volume, and that wrote upon occasion of the public resolutioners, which has already been mentioned, some other little pieces of his has been published since. There is also a book in quarto said to be his, entitled "An Useful Case of Conscience Learnedly and Acutely Discussed and Resolved Concerning Association and Confederacies with Idolaters, Heretics, Malignants, and so forth," first printed in the year 1693, which was like to have had some influence at that time upon King William's soldiers while in Flanders, which made him suppress it, and raise a persecution against Mr. James Kidd for publishing the same at Ulrich in the Netherlands. The Life of Mr. Andrew Gray. Mr. Andrew Gray, by the calculation of his age and the date of his entry into the ministry, seems to have been born about the year 1634, and being very early sent to school, where he learned so fast that in a short time he was sent to the university, and here by the vivacity of his parts and ready genius, he made such proficiency, both in scholastic learning and divinity, that before he was 20 years of age, he was found accomplished for entering into the holy office of the ministry. From his very infancy, he had studied to be acquainted with the scriptures, and like another young Samson, the Spirit of God began early to move him, there being such a delightful gravity in his young conversation that what Gregory Nazianzen once said of the great Basil might be applied to him. Quote, "But it held forth learning beyond his age, and fixedness of manner beyond his learning." This earthly vessel, thus being filled with heavenly treasure, he was quickly licensed to preach, and got a call to be minister of the outer kirk of the High Church of Glasgow, though he was scarce 20 years of age complete, far below the age appointed by the constitution of this church, unless in case extraordinary. No sooner was this young servant of Christ entered into his master's vineyard than the people from all quarters flocked to attend his sermons, it being their constant emulation who should be most under the refreshing drops of his ministry, insomuch that he and his learned colleague, Mr. Durham, were one time walking together, Mr. Durham observing the multitude thronging into the church where Mr. Gray was to preach, and only a very few going into the church in which he was to preach, said to him, "Brother, I perceive you are to have a thronged church today." To which he answered, "Truly, brother, they are fools to leave you and come to me." Mr. Durham replied, "Not so, dear brother, for none can receive such honor and success in his ministry, except it be given him from heaven. I rejoice that Christ is preached and that his kingdom and interest is getting ground, for I am content to be anything or nothing, that Christ may be all in all." And indeed Mr. Gray had a notable and singular gift in preaching, being one experienced in the most mysterious points of Christian practice and profession, and in handling of all his subjects, free of youthful vanity and affectation of human literature, though he had a most scholastic genius and more than ordinary abilities, that he did outstrip many that entered into the Lord's vineyard before him, his experience being very warm and rapturous and well adapted to affect the hearts of his hearers. Yea, he had such a faculty and was so helped to press home God's threatenings upon the conscience of his hearers that his contemporary, the aforesaid Mr. Durham, observed that many times he caused the very hairs of their head to stand up. Among his other excellencies in preaching, which were many, this was none of the least, that he would so order his subject as to make it relish every palate. He would so dress a plain discourse as to delight a learned audience, and at the same time preach with a learned plainness, having so learned to conceal his art. He had such a clear notion of high mysteries as to make them stoop to the meanest capacity. He had so learned Christ, and being a man of most zealous temper, the great bent of his spirit and that which he did spend himself a net was to make people know their dangerous state of nature, and to persuade them to believe and lay hold of the great salvation. All which singularities seem to have been his peculiar mercy from the Lord, to make him a burning and shining light in the western climate for about the space of 2 years only. The Spirit of the Lord, as it was stirring up a lamp into a sudden blaze, that was not to continue long in his church, on which a late professor of some of his sermons was very pertinently observed. Quote, "Yea, how awakening, convincing, and reproving may the examples of this very young minister be to many ministers of the gospel, who have many years in the vineyard, but fall short of his labors and progress. God thinks fit now and then to raise up a child to reprove the sloth and negligence of many thousands of advanced years, and shows that he can perfect his own praise out of the mouth of babes." Unquote. The sermons are now in print and well known in the world. His works do praise him in the gates, and though they are free from the metaphysical speculations of the schools, yet it must be granted that the excellencies of the ancient fathers and schoolmen do all concenter in them, for his doctrine carries light, his reproofs are weighty, and his exhortations powerful, and though they are not in such an accurate or grammatical style as some may expect, yet they may be easily accounted for if we consider 1. The great alteration and embellishment in the style of the English language since his time, and 2. There can be no ground to doubt that they must be far inferior unto what they were when delivered by the author, who whether corrected nor as appears intended that they should ever be published. And all this is sufficiently made up otherwise, for what is wanting in symmetry of parts or equality of style, in the pleasure of variety, like the grateful odors of various flowers, or the pleasant harmony of different sounds, for so is truth at its own native dress. It hath been often said to Mr. Gray many times long for the 22nd year of his age, wherein he expected to rest from his labors by a perpetual jubilee, to enjoy his blessed Lord and Master. However, it is certain that in his sermons we often find him longing for his majority, that he might enter into the possession of his heavenly Father's inheritance prepared for him before the foundation of the world were laid. He escaped death very narrowly when going to Dundee in company of Mr. Robert Fleming, sometime minister at Camelflang. But remarkably, sea deliverance was a matter of his thankfulness to God all his life after. There is one thing that may be desiderated by the Inquisition, i.e., that Mr. Gray's sentiments were concerning the public resolutions, seeing that he entered the ministry about the third year after these resolutions took place. Whatever his contentions in public were, it is credibly reported that he debated in private against these defections with his learned colleague, Mr. Durham, who afterwards, in his deathbed, asked what he thought of these things. He answered that he was of the same mind with what he had formerly heard, and did much regret that he had so sparingly in public against these woeful resolutions, speaking so pathetically of their sinfulness and the calamities that they would procure, that Mr. Durham, contrary to his former practice, durst never speak in defense of them. But the time now approaching that the Lord was about to accomplish the desire of his servant, he fell sick, and was cast into a high fever for several days. He was much tossed with sore trouble, without any intermission, and all the time continued in a most sedate frame of mind. It is a loss that his last dying words were neither wrote nor remembered, only we may guess what his spiritual exercises were from that short but excellent letter sent from him a little before his death to Lord Warriston, bearing date February 7, 1656, wherein he shows that he not only had a most clear discovery of the toleration then granted by Cromwell and the evils that would come upon these lands for all these things, but also was most sensible of his own case and condition, as appears from the conclusion of that letter, where he accosts his lordship thus, quote, "Now, not to trouble your lordship, whom I highly reverence, and my soul was knit to you in the Lord, but that you will bespeak my case to the great master of requests, and lay my broken state before him who hath pled the desperate case of many according to the sweet Lord, in Lamentations 3, verses 5 and 6, thou hast heard my voice, hide not thine ear," and so forth. This is all that this time for one in a very weak condition, in a great fever, who for much of 7 nights hath slept little at all, with many other sad particulars and circumstances. End of quote. Thus in a short time, according to his desire, it was granted him by death to pass into the author of life, his soul taking its flight into the arms of his blessed Savior, whom he had served faithfully in his day and generation, being about 22 years old. He shone too conspicuous to continue long, and burned so intensely, he behooved soon to be extinguished, but now shines in the kingdom of his Father in a more conspicuous, resultant manner, even as the brightness of the firmament and the stars forever and ever. He was in his day a most singular and pious youth, and though he died young, yet was old in grace, having lived long and done much for God in a little time, being one both in public and private life, who possessed in a high degree every domestic and social virtue that could adorn the character of a most powerful and pathetic preacher, a loving husband, an affable friend, ever cheerful and agreeable in conversation, always ready to exert himself for the relief of all who asked for and stood in need of his assistance, which uncommon talents not only endeared him to his brethren the clergy, but also to many others from the one extremity of the lands to the other, that heard or knew anything of him, who considered and highly esteemed him as one of the most able advocates of the propagation and advancement of Christ's kingdom. His well-known sermons are printed in several small pieces. Those called his works are bound in one volume octavo. To the 11 sermons printed some time ago are lately published a large collection to the number of 51 entitled His Select Sermons, wherein only 3, for connection's sake, and his letter to Lord Warriston are inserted, which were before published in his works, so that by this time most, if not all, of the sermons are now in print that were preached by him. The life of Mr. James Durham. Mr. James Durham was born about the year 1622, and lineally descended from the ancient and honorable family of Grange Durham, in the parish of Monyseth in the Shire of Angus. He was the eldest son of John Durham of Easter Powery, Esquire, now called Wedderburn, after the gentleman's name, who is the present possessor there. Having gone through all the parts of useful learning with success and applause, he left the university before he was graduate, and for some time lived as a private gentleman at his own dwelling house in the country, without any thought then of further prosecuting his studies, especially for the ministry. And though he was always blameless and moral in his life, both in the university and when he left it, yet he was much a stranger to religion in the serious exercise and power of it, and through prejudice of education did not stand well affected to the Presbyterial government. He first married a daughter of the Laird of Dunderby. His wife and her mother were both very pious women. His conversion to the Lord was very remarkable, for going with his lady to visit her mother in the parish of Abercorn, some miles west from Edinburgh, it happened that at this time the sacrament was to be administered in the parish upon Saturday. His mother-in-law earnestly pressed them to go with them to church and hear sermon. At first he showed much unwillingness, but partly by their persuasion and partly by his complacent disposition, he went along with them. The minister that preached that day was extremely affectionate and serious in his delivery, and though the sermon was a plain, familiar discourse, yet his seriousness fixed Mr. Durham's attention very closely, and he was much affected therewith. But the change was reserved till the morrow. When he came home, he said to his mother-in-law, "The minister hath preached very seriously today. I shall not need to be pressed to go to church tomorrow." Accordingly, on Sabbath morning, rising early, he went to church, where Mr. Melville preached from 2 Peter chapter 2, verse 7, "To you that believe, he is precious," and so forth, where he so sweetly and seriously opened up the preciousness of Christ, and the Spirit of God wrought so effectively upon his spirit that in hearing this sermon he first closed with Christ, then went to the Lord's table and took the seal of God's covenant. After this, he ordinarily called Mr. Melville Father when he spoke of him. Afterward, he made serious religion his business both in secret and in his family and in all places and companies where he came, and did cordially embrace the interests of Christ and his church as then established, and gave himself much up to reading, for which reason, that he might be free of all disturbance, and so forth, he caused built a study for himself, in which little chamber he gave himself to prayer, reading, and meditation, and was so close a student there that he often forgot to eat his bread, being sometimes so intent upon his studies that servants who were sent to call him down often returned without answer, yea, his lady frequently called on him with tears before he would come. Such sweet communion he had with the Lord sometimes in that place. He made great proficiency in his studies, and not only became an experimental Christian, but also a very learned man, what evidence of which he gave in a short dispute with one of the ministers of Dundee while he was in that town. He met, in a house where he was occasionally, with the parson of the parish, for so the ministers were then called, who then did not know Mr. Durham. After some discourse, he fell upon the popish controversy with him, and so put him to silence that he could not answer a word, but went sneakingly out of the room from Mr. Durham to the provost, craving his assistance to apprehend Mr. Durham as a Jesuit, assuring the provost that if ever there was a Jesuit in Rome, he was one, and that if he were suffered to remain in the town or country, he might pervert many from the faith. Upon which the provost, going along with him to the house where he pretended Jesuit was, entering the room, he immediately knew Mr. Durham, and saluted him as Laird of Easter Powery, craving his pardon for their mistake. Turning to the parson, asked where the person was he called the Jesuit. Mr. Durham smiled. The parson, ashamed, asked pardon from them both, and was rebuked by the provost, who said, "Fie, fie, that any country gentleman should be able to put our parson thus to silence." His call in coming forth to the ministry was somewhat remarkable, for in the time when the civil wars broke forth, several gentlemen being in arms for the cause of religion, among whom he was chosen and called to be captain, in which station he behaved himself like another Cornelius, being a devout man, and one that feared God with all his house, and prayed to God always with his company, and so forth. When the Scots army were about to engage the English, he judged meet to call his company to prayer before the engagement, and as he began to pray, Mr. David Dixon, then professor of divinity at Glasgow, coming past the army, seeing the soldiers addressing themselves to prayer, and hearing the voice of one praying, drew near, alighted from his horse, and joined with them, was so much taken with Mr. Durham's prayer that he called for the captain, and having conversed with him a little, he solemnly charged him that as soon as this piece of service was over, he should devote himself to serve God in the holy ministry, for to that he judged the Lord called him. But though as yet Mr. Durham had no clearness of hearken in Mr. Dixon's advice, yet two remarkable providences falling out just upon the back of this solemn charge served very much to clear his way to comply with Mr. Dixon's desire. The first was, In the engagement, his horse was shot under him, and he was mercifully preserved. The second was, in the heat of the battle, an English soldier was on the point of striking him down with his sword, but apprehending him to be a minister by his grave carriage, black cloth, and band, as was then in fashion with gentlemen, he asked him if he was a priest, to which Mr. Durham replied, "I am one of God's priests," and he spared his life. Mr. Durham, upon reflecting how wonderfully the Lord had spared him and preserved his life, and that his saying that he was a priest had been the mean thereof, resolved therefore, as a testimony of his grateful and thankful sense of the Lord's goodness to him, henceforth to devote himself to the service of God in the holy ministry, if the Lord should see meet to qualify him for the same. Accordingly, in pursuance of this resolution, he quickly went to Glasgow and studied divinity under Mr. David Dixon, then professor there, and made such proficiency therein that in a short time, being called thereto, he humbly offered himself to trials in the year 1646, and so was licensed by the Presbytery of Irvine to preach the gospel. And next year, upon Mr. Dixon's recommendation, the session of Glasgow appointed Mr. Ramsay, one of their ministers, to entreat Mr. Durham to come and preach in Glasgow. Accordingly, he came and preached 2 Sabbath days and 1 weekday. The session being fully satisfied with his doctrine and the gifts bestowed on him by the Lord for serving him in the holy ministry, did unanimously call him to ministry of the Blackfriar Church, then vacant, in consequence of which he was ordained minister there in November 1647. He applied himself to the work of the ministry with great diligence, so that his profiting did quickly appear to all. But considering that no man that warreth entangleth himself with the affairs of this life, he obtained leave of his people to return to his own country for a little time to settle his worldly affairs there. Yet he was not idle here, but preached every Sabbath. He first preached at Dundee before a great multitude from Romans chapter 1, verse 16, "I am not ashamed of the gospel of Christ," and showed that it was no disparagement for the greatest to be a gospel minister. And a second time he preached at Furling in his own country. Upon 2 Corinthians chapter 5, verse 13, "He hath given to us the ministry of reconciliation," and so forth. And a third time at Moniseth, at the desire of the minister there, he preached from 2 Corinthians, verse 26, "We then are ambassadors for Christ," and so forth. In both places he indeed acted like an ambassador for Christ, and managed the gospel treaty of peace to good purpose. The next Sabbath he designed to have preached at Moros, but receiving an express to return to Glasgow in haste, his wife being dangerously sick, he came away, leaving his affairs to the care of his friends, and returned to Glasgow, where in a few days his wife, who had been the desire of his eyes, died. His Christian submission under this afflicting dispensation was most remarkable. After a short silence, he said to some about him, "Now who could persuade me that this dispensation of God's providence was good for me, if the Lord hath not said it was so?" He was afterward married to Margaret Muir, relic of Mr. Zechariah Boyd, minister of the barony of Glasgow. In the year 1650, Mr. Dixon, professor of divinity in the College of Glasgow, being called to be professor of divinity in the University of Edinburgh, the commissioners of the General Assembly authorized for visiting the University of Glasgow unanimously designed and called Mr. Durham to succeed Mr. Dixon as professor there. But before he was admitted to that charge, the General Assembly of this church, being persuaded of his eminent piety, steadfastness, prudence, and moderation, did, after mature deliberation that same year, pitch upon him, though then about 28 years of age, as among the blessed and best accomplished ministers then in the church, to attend the king's family as chaplain. In which station, though the times were most difficult, as abounding with snares and temptations, he did so wisely and faithfully acquit himself that there was a conviction left upon the consciences of all who observed him. Yea, during his stay at court, and whenever he went about the duty of his place, they did all carry gravely, and did forbear all lightness and profanity, none allowing themselves to do anything offensive before him. So that while he served the Lord in the holy ministry, and particularly that post and character of the king's chaplain, his ambition was to have God's favor rather than the favor of great men, and studied more to profit and edify their souls than to tickle their fancy, as some court parasites in their sermons do. One instance thereof was, being called to preach before the Parliament, where many rulers were present, he preached from John 3, verse 10, "Art thou a master in Israel, and knowest not these things?" when he mostly insisted that it is a most unaccountable thing for rulers and nobles in Israel to be ignorant of the great and necessary things of regeneration, and being born again of the Spirit, and did most seriously press all, from the king to the beggar, to seek and know experimentally these things, a good pattern for all ministers who were called to preach on the like occasion. He continued with the king till he went to England, and then returned. Towards the end of January 1651, the Common Sessions of Glasgow appointed Mr. Patrick Gillespie to write a letter to Mr. Durham concerning Mr. Robert Ramsay's being Professor of Divinity in place of the said Mr. James Durham in the University of Glasgow, in consequence of which Mr. Durham came to Glasgow, for he is mentioned present in the session in the beginning of April next. At the same time, Cromwell and his army were in Glasgow, and on the Lord's Day Cromwell heard Mr. Durham preach, when he testified against his invasion to his face. Next day he sent for Mr. Durham and told him he always thought he had been a wiser man than to meddle with matters of public concern in his sermons, to which he answered it was not his practice, but that he judged it both wisdom and prudence to speak his mind on that head, seeing he had the opportunity to do it in his presence. Cromwell dismissed him with very civilly, but desired him to forbear insisting on that subject in public. At the same time, some sundry ministers, both in town and country, met with Cromwell and his officers, and represented in strong terms the injustice of his invasion. It would appear that Mr. Durham, some time after this, had withdrawn from Glasgow, and therefore a letter was, in August next, ordered to be sent to him to come and visit them and preach. And in September next, there being a vacancy in the inner kirk by the death of Mr. Ramsay, the Common Session gave it a unanimous call, with which the town council agreed, to Mr. Durham to be minister there. And sometime after this, he was received minister in the inner kirk, Mr. John Carstairs, his brother-in-law, being his colleague in that church. In the whole of his ministry, he was a burning and shining light, and particularly he shined in humility and self-denial, an instance of which was upon a day when Mr. Andrew Gray and he were to preach, being walking together, Mr. Durham, observing multitudes thronging to Mr. Gray's church, and only a few into his, said to Mr. Gray, "Brother, you are like to have a thronged church today." To which Mr. Gray answered, "Truly, brother, they are fools to leave you and come to me." "Not so, dear brother," replied Mr. Durham, "for a minister can receive no such honor and success in his ministry except to be given him from heaven. I rejoice that Christ is preached, though my esteem in people's hearts should decrease and be diminished, for I am content to be anything so that Christ be all in all." He was also a person of the utmost gravity, and scarce smiled at anything. Once when Mr. William Guthrie, being exceeding merry, made Mr. Durham smile with his pleasant, facetious, and harmless conversations, at which Mr. Durham was at first a little disgusted, but it being the laudable custom of that family to pray after dinner, which Mr. Guthrie did, upon being desired, with the greatest measure of seriousness and fervency, to the astonishment of all present, when they arose from prayer, Mr. Durham embraced him and said, "O William, you are a happy man. If I had been so merry as you have been, I could not have been in such a serious frame for prayer for the space of 48 hours. As Mr. Durham was devout in all parts of his ministerial work, so more eminently at communion occasions, then he endeavored through grace to rouse and work up himself to such a divineness of frame as very much suited the spiritual state and majesty of that ordinance. Yea, at some of these solemn and sweet occasions he spoke some way as a man that had been in heaven commending Jesus Christ, making a glorious display of free grace, and brought the offers thereof so low that they were made to think the rope or cord of the salvation offered was let down to sinners, that those of the lowest stature might catch hold of it. He gave himself much to the meditation, and usually said little to persons that came to propose their cases to him, but heard them patiently, and was sure to handle their case in his sermons. His healing disposition and great moderation of spirit remarkably appeared when this church was grievously divided betwixt the resolutioners and protesters, and as he would never give his judgment upon either side, so he used to say that division was worse by far than either of the sides. He was equally respected by both parties, for at a meeting of the Synod of Glasgow, when those of the different sides met separately, each of them made choice of Mr. Durham for their moderator. But he refused to join either of them till they would both unite together, which they accordingly did. At this meeting, he gave in some overture for peace the substance of that which was that they should eschew all public awakening or lengthening out of the debate, either by preaching or spreading of papers on either side, and that they should forbear practicing, executing, or pressing of acts that made in the last assembly of St. Andrews in Dundee, and also pressing or spreading appeals, declinature, and etc., against the same, and that no church officer should be expected on account of these things, they being found otherwise qualified, and so forth. So weighty was the ministerial charge upon his spirit that if he were to live 10 years longer, he would choose to live 9 years in study for preaching the 10th, and it was thought this close study and his thoughtfulness cast him into that decay wherefore he died. In the time of his sickness, the better part being afraid that the magistrates and some of the ministry who were in the public resolutions would put in one of that stamp after his death, moved Mr. Carstairs to his colleague in a visit to desire him to name him successor, which, after some demur, enjoined secrecy till it was near his death. He at last named Mr. David Betch, then minister of Govan, but afterwards, when dying, to the magistrates, ministers, and some of the people, he named other three to take any of them they pleased. This alteration made Mr. Carstairs inquire the reason after the rest were gone, to whom Mr. Durham replied, "O brother, Mr. Betch is too ripe for heaven to be transported to any church on earth. He will be there almost as soon as I." Which proved so, for Mr. Durham died the Friday after, and the next Sabbath Mr. Vetch preached, and though knowing nothing of this, told the people in the afternoon it would be his last sermon to them. The same night, taking bed, he died next Friday afternoon about 3 o'clock, the time that Mr. Durham died, as Dr. Rattray, who was witness to both, did declare. When on his deathbed he was under considerable darkness about his fate, and said to Mr. John Carstairs' brother, "For all that I have preached or written, there is but one scripture I can remember or dare grip unto. Tell me, if dare say, the weight of my salvation upon it. Whosoever cometh unto me, I will in no ways cast off." Mr. Carstairs answered, "You may depend on it, though you had 1,000 salvations at hazard." When he was drawing towards his departure, in a great conflict and agony, finding some difficulty in his passage, yet he sensibly, through the strength of God's grace, triumphantly overcame. He cried out in a rapture of holy joy some little time before he committed his soul to God, "Is not the Lord good? Is he not infinitely good? See how he smiles. I do say it, and I do proclaim it." He died on Friday, the 25th of June, 1658, in the 36th year of his age. Thus died the eminently pious, learned, and judicious Mr. James Durham, whose labors did always aim at the advancement of practical religion, and whose praise in the gospel is throughout all the churches, both at home and abroad. He was a burning and shining light, a star of the first magnitude, and of whom it may be said, without derogating from the merit of any, that he attained unto the first three and had a name among the mighty. He was also one of great integrity and authority in the country where he lived, insomuch that when any difference fell out, he was always chosen by both parties as their great referee or judge, unto whose sentence all parties submitted. Such was the quality of his calm and healing spirit. His colleague, Mr. John Carstairs, in his funeral sermon from Isaiah 52, verses 1 and 2, "The righteous man perish, and no one layeth it to heart," gives him this character: "Know ye not that there is a prince among pastors fallen today, a faithful and wise steward, that knew well how to give God's children their food in due season, a gentle and kind nurse, a faithful admonisher, reprover, and so forth, a skillful counselor in all straits and difficulties. In dark matters he was eyes to the blind, feet to the lame, a burning and shining light in the dark world, an interpreter of the word among thousand. To him men gave ear, and after his words no man spake again." His learned and pious works, wherein all these excellencies of the primitive and ancient fathers seem to concenter, are a commentary on the Revelation, 72 sermons on the 53rd chapter of the prophecy of the prophet Isaiah, an exposition of the Ten Commandments, an exposition of the Song of Solomon, his sermons on death, on the unsearchable riches of Christ, his communion sermons, sermons on godliness and self-denial, a sermon on a good conscience. There are also a great many of his sermons in manuscript, never yet published, namely, three sermons about resisting the Holy Ghost from Acts chapter 7, verse 51, 8 on quenching the Spirit, 5 upon giving the Spirit, 13 upon trusting and delighting in God, 2 against immoderate anxiety, 8 upon the one thing needful, with a discourse upon prayer, and several other sermons and discourses from Ephesians chapter 5, verse 15, 1 Corinthians 11, verse 24, Luke chapter 1, verse 6, Galatians chapter 5, verse 16, Psalm 119, verse 67, 1 Thessalonians chapter 5, verse 19, 1 Peter 3, verse 14, Matthew chapter 8, verse 7. There is also a treatise on scandal and an exposition by way of lecture upon Job said to be his. But whether these, either as to style or strain, cohere with the other works of the laborious Mr. Durham, must be left to the impartial and unbiased reader. The Life of Mr. Samuel Rutherford. Mr. Samuel Rutherford, a gentleman by extraction, having spent some time at Greenwich School, went to the University of Edinburgh, where he was so much admired for his pregnancy of parts and deservedly looked upon as one from whom some great things might be expected, that in a short time, though then but very young, he was made professor of philosophy in that university. Sometime after this, he was called to be minister at Anlath in the Shire of Galway, into which charge he entered by means of the then Viscount of Kilmore, without any acknowledgement or engagement to the bishops. There he labored with great diligence and success, both night and day, rising usually by 3 o'clock in the morning, spending the whole time in reading, praying, writing, catechizing, visiting, and other duties belonging to the ministerial profession and employment. Here he wrote his Exhortations de Gratia, for which he was summoned as early as June 1630 before the High Commission Court, but the weather was so tempestuous as to obstruct the passage of the Archbishop of St. Andrews hither, and Mr. Colville, one of the judges, having befriended him, the diet was deserted. About the same time, his first wife died after a sore sickness of 13 months, and he himself being so ill of a tertian fever for 13 weeks, that then he could not preach on the Sabbath day without great difficulty. Again in April 1634, he was threatened with another prosecution at the instance of the Bishop of Galway before the High Commission Court, and neither hear these threatenings all the reasons Mr. Rutherford had to lay his account with suffering. And as the Lord would not hide from his faithful servant Abraham the thing he was about to do, neither would he conceal from this son of Abraham what his purpose were concerning him. For in a letter to the provost's wife of Kirkcudbright, dated April 20, 1633, he says that upon the 17th and 18th of August he got a full answer of his Lord to be a graced minister, and he chose an arrow hid in his quiver. Accordingly, the thing he looked for came upon him, for he was again summoned before the High Commission Court for his nonconformity, his preaching against the 5 Articles of Perth, and the forementioned book, and Exhortations Apologica pro Divina Grata, which book they allege did reflect upon the Church of Scotland, but the truth was, says a later historian, the argument of that book did cut the sinews of Arminianism and gall the Episcopal clergy to the very quick, and so Bishop Sittersert would endure him no longer. When he came before the Commission Court, he altogether declined them as a lawful judicatory, and would not give the Chancellor, being a clergyman, and the bishops their titles by lording of them. Yet some had the courage to befriend him, particularly the Lord Lorne, afterwards the famous Marquis of Argyll, who did as much for him as was within his power to do. But the Bishop of Galway, threatening that if he got not his will of him, he would write to the king, it was carried against him, and upon the 27th of July, 1636, he was discharged to exercise any part of his ministry within the Kingdom of Scotland under pain of rebellion, and ordered within 6 months to confine himself within the city of Aberdeen and so forth during the king's pleasure, which sentence he obeyed, and forthwith went toward the place of his confinement. From Aberdeen he wrote many of his famous letters, from which it is evident that the consolation of the Holy Spirit did greatly abound with him in his sufferings. Yea, in one of these letters he expresses it in the strongest terms, when he says, quote, I never knew before that his love was in such a measure. If he leaves me, he leaves me in pain and sick of love. And yet my sickness is my life and health. I have a fire within me. I defy all the devils in hell and all the prelates in Scotland to cast water on it. End of quote. Here he remained upwards of a year and a half, by which time he made the doctors of Aberdeen know that the Puritans, as they called them, were clergymen as well as they, but upon notice that the Privy Council had received a declinature against the High Commission Court in the year 1638, he adventured to return back again to his flock at Anwath, where he again took great pains, both in public and private, amongst that people, who from all quarters resorted to his ministry, so that the whole countryside might account themselves to his particular flock, and it being then in the dawning of the Reformation, found no small benefit by the gospel, that part of the ancient prophecy being farther accomplished, for in the wilderness shall waters break out, and streams in the desert. Isaiah 35, verse 6. He was before that venerable assembly held at Glasgow in 1638, and gave an account of all these his former proceedings with respect to his confinement and the cause thereof. By them he was appointed to be Professor of Divinity at St. Andrews and colleague in the ministry with the worthy Mr. Blair, who was translated hither about the same time. And here God did again so second this, his eminent and faithful servant, that by his indefatigable pains both in teaching and in the schools and preaching in the congregations, St. Andrews, the seat of the Archbishop, and by that means the nursery of all superstition, error, and profaneness, soon became forthwith a Lebanon out of which were taken cedars for building the house of the Lord, almost through the whole land, many of whom he guided to heaven before himself, who received the spiritual life by his ministry, and many others did walk in that light after him. And as he was mighty in the public parts of religion, so he was a great practicer and encourager of the private duties thereof. Thus in the year 1640, when a charge was foisted in before the General Assembly at the instance of Mr. Henry Guthrie, minister at Stirling, afterward Bishop of Dunkeld, against private society meetings, which were then abounding in the land, on which ensued much reasoning, the one side yielding that a paper before drawn up by Mr. Henderson should be agreed unto concerning the order to be kept in these meetings, and so forth. But Guthrie and his adherents opposing this, Mr. Rutherford, who was never much disposed to speak in judicatories, threw in this syllogism. Quote, "What the scriptures do warrant, no assembly may discharge, but private meetings for religious exercise the scriptures do warrant." Malachi chapter 5, verse 16. "Then they that feared the Lord spake often one to another," and so forth. James chapter 5, verse 16. "Confess your faults one to another, and pray one for another," and so forth. These things could not be done in public meetings, and so forth. And although the Earl of Seaforth, there present, and those of Guthrie's faction upbraided this good man for this, yet it had influence upon the majority of the members, so that all the opposite party got done was an act anent the ordering of family worship. He was also one of the Scots commissioners appointed in the year 1643 to the Westminster Assembly, and was very much beloved there for his unparalleled faithfulness and zeal in going about his master's business. It was during this time that he published Lairay and several other learned pieces against the Erastians, Anabaptists, Independents, and other sectaries that began to prevail and increase at that time, and none ever had the courage to take up the gauntlet of defiance thrown down by this champion. A footnote to the text reads as follows. It is reported that when King Charles saw Lairay, he said it would scarcely ever get an answer, nor did it ever get any, except what the Parliament in 1661 gave it, when they caused it to be burnt at the cross at Edinburgh by the hands of the hangman. We return to our text. When the principal business of this assembly was pretty well settled, Mr. Rutherford, on October 24, 1647, moved that it might be recorded in the scribe's book that the assembly had enjoyed the assistance of the commissioners of the Church of Scotland all the time they had been debating and perfecting these four things mentioned in the Solemn League, namely, their composing a directory for the worship, a uniform confession of faith, a form of church government and discipline, and the public catechism, which was done in about a week after he and the rest returned home. Upon the death of the learned De Matthias in the year 1651, the magistrates of Utrecht in Holland, being abundantly satisfied as to the learning, piety, and true zeal of the great Mr. Rutherford, invited him to the divinity chair there, but he could not be persuaded. His reasons elsewhere, when dissuading another gentleman from going abroad, seemed to be expressed in these words, quote, "Let me entreat you to be far from the thoughts of leaving this land. I see it and find it, that the Lord hath covered the whole land with a cloud in his anger. But though I have been tempted to the like, I had rather be in Scotland beside angry Jesus Christ, knowing he mindeth no evil to us, than in any Eden or garden on the earth. End of quote. From which it is evident that he chose rather to suffer affliction in his own native country than to leave his charge and flock in time of danger. He continued with them till the day of his death in the free and faithful discharge of his duty. When the unhappy difference fell out between those called the protesters and the public resolutioners in the years 1650 and 1651, he espoused the protesters' quarrel and gave faithful warning against these public resolutions, and likewise during the time of Cromwell's usurpation, he contended against all the prevailing sectaries that then ushered in with the sectaries by virtue of his toleration. And such was his unwearied assiduity and diligence that he seemed to pray constantly, to preach constantly, to catechize constantly, and to visit the sick, exhorting them from house to house, to teach as much in the schools and spend as much time with the students and young men in fitting them for the ministry as if he had been sequestrate from all the world besides, and yet withal to write as much as he had been constantly shut up in his study. But no sooner did the restoration of Charles II take place than the face of affairs began to change, and after his forementioned book Larrey was burnt at the cross of Edinburgh and at the gates of the new College of St. Andrews, where he was professor of divinity, the Parliament in 1661 were to have an indictment laid before them against him, and such was their humanity, when everybody knew he was a dying, that they caused summon him to appear before them at Edinburgh to answer to a charge of high treason. But he had a higher tribunal to appear before, for his judge was his friend, and was dead before that time came, being taken away from the evil to come. There's a footnote to the text concerning his death and this summons, which reads as follows. It is commonly said that when the summons came, he spoke out of his bed and said, "Tell him I have got summons already before a superior judge in Judicatory, and behove to answer my first summons, and ere your day come, I will be where few kings and great folks come." When they returned and told he was a dying, the Parliament put to vote whether or not to let him die in the college. It carried, put him out, only a few dissenting. My Lord Burlough said, "We have voted that honest man out of the college, but you cannot vote him out of heaven." Some said he would never win there. Hell was too good for him. Burleigh said, "I wish I were as for heaven as he is. I would think myself happy to get a grip of his sleeve to haul me in." We return to our main text. When on his deathbed, he lamented much that he was withheld from bearing witness to the work of reformation since the year 1638, and upon the 28th of February he gave a large and faithful testimony against the sinful courses of that time, which testimony he subscribed 12 days before his death, being full of joy and peace in believing. During the time of his last sickness, he uttered many savory speeches and often broke out in a kind of sacred rapture, exulting and commending the Lord Jesus, especially when his end drew near. He often called his blessed Master his kingly King. Some days before his death, he said, quote, "I shall shine, I shall see him as he is, I shall see him reign and all his fair company with him, and I shall have my larger share. Mine eyes shall see my Redeemer, these very eyes of mine, and none other for me. This may seem a wide word, but it is no fancy or delusion. It is true. Let my Lord's name be exalted, and if he will, let my name be grinded to pieces, that he may be all in all. If he should slay me 10,000 times, I will trust." End of quote. He often repeated Jeremiah 15, verse 16, "Thy words were found, and I did eat them," and so forth. When exhorting one to diligence, he said, quote, "It is no easy thing to be a Christian. For me, I got the victory, and Christ is holding out both his arms to embrace me." End of quote. At another time, to some friends present, he said, quote, "At the beginning of my sufferings, I had my own fears like other sinful men, lest I should faint and not be carried credibly through. And I laid this before the Lord, and as sure as ever he spoke to me in his word, as sure as his Spirit witnesseth to my heart, he hath accepted my sufferings. He said to me, 'Fear not, the outgate shall not be simply matter of prayer, but matter of praise.' I said to the Lord, 'If he should slay me 5,000 times 5,000, I would trust in him.' And I speak it with much trembling, fearing I should not make good my part. But as really as ever he spoke to me by his Spirit, He witnessed to my heart, and his grace should be sufficient. End of quote. The Thursday night before his death, being much grieved with the state of the public, he made this expression, "Horror hath taken hold of me." And afterwards, falling on his own condition, he said, "I renounce all that ever he made me will and do as defiled and imperfect as coming from me. I betake myself to Christ for sanctification as well as justification." Repeating these words, "He has made of God to me wisdom, righteousness, and so forth," adding, "I close with it. Let him be so. He is my all in all." March 17th, three gentle women came to see him, and after exhorting them to read the word and be much in prayer and much in communion with God, he said, quote, "My honorable master and lovely Lord, my great royal king hath not a match in heaven nor earth. I have my own guilt, even like other sinful men, but he hath pardoned, loved, washed, and given me joy unspeakable and full of glory. I repent not that I ever owned his cause. These, whom ye call protesters, are the witnesses of Jesus Christ. I hope never to depart from that cause, nor side with those that have burnt the causes of God's wrath. They have broken their covenant oftener than once or twice, but I believe the Lord will build Zion and repair the waste places of Jacob. Oh, to obtain mercy, to wrestle with God for their salvation. As for this presbytery, it has stood in opposition of me these years past. I have my record in heaven. I had no particular end in view, but was seeking the honor of God, the thriving of the gospel in this place, and the good of the new college, that society which I have left upon the Lord. What personal wrongs they have done me, and what grief they have occasioned to me, I heartily forgive them, and desire mercy to wrestle with God for mercy to them, and for the salvation of them all." End of quote. The same day, Messrs. James McGill, John Wardlow, William Vallant, and Alexander Wedderburn, all members of the same presbytery with him, coming to visit him, he made them welcome and said, "My Lord and my Master is the chief of 10,000. None is comparable to him in heaven or earth. Dear brethren, do all for him. Pray for Christ. Preach for Christ. Feed the flock committed to your charge for Christ. Do all for Christ. Beware of men pleasing. There is too much of it amongst us. The new college hath broke my heart, and I can say nothing of it. I have left it upon the Lord of the house, and hath been done, and still is my desire that he may dwell in this society, and that the youth may be fed with sound knowledge." After this he said, "Dear brethren, it may seem presumptuous in me, a particular man, to send a commission to a presbytery." And Mr. McGill, replying that it was no presumption, he continued, "Dear brethren, take a commission from me, a dying man, to them to appear for God and his cause, and adhere to the doctrine of the covenant, and have a care of the flock committed to their charge. Let them feed the flock out of love, preach for God, visit and catechize for God, and do all for God. Beware of men pleasing. The chief shepherd will appear shortly," and so forth. "I have been a sinful man, and have had my own failings, but my Lord hath pardoned and accepted my labors. I adhere to the cause and covenant, and resolve never to depart from the protestations and against the controverted assemblies. I am the man I was. I am still for keeping the government of the Kirk of Scotland entire, and would not for a thousand worlds have had the least hand in the burning of the causes of God's wrath. Oh, for grace to wrestle with God for their salvation." Mr. Vallant, having prayed at his desire, as they took their leave, he renewed their charge to them to feed the flock out of love. The next morning, as he recovered out of a fainting in which they who looked on expected his disillusion, he said, I feel, I believe, I joy, and rejoice, I feed on manna." Mr. Blair, whose praise is in the churches, being present, he took a little wine and a spoon to refresh himself, being then very weak. He said to him, "Ye feed on dainties in heaven, and think nothing of our cordials on earth." He answered, "They are all but dung, but they are Christ's creatures, and out of obedience of his command I take them. Mine eyes shall see my Redeemer. I know that he shall stand the last day upon the earth, and I shall be caught up in the clouds to meet him in the air, and I shall be ever with him. And what would you have more? There is an end." And stretching out his hands, he said again, "There is an end." And a little after he said, "I have been a single man, but I stand at the best pass that ever a man did. Christ is mine, and I am his, and spoke much of the white stone and new name. Mr. Blair, who loved with all his heart to hear Christ commended, said to him again, What think you now of Christ? To which he answered, I shall live and adore him. Glory, glory to my Creator and my Redeemer forever. Glory shines in Emmanuel's land. In the afternoon of that day he said, Oh, that all my brethren in the public may know what a master I have served, and what peace I have this day. I shall sleep in Christ, and when I awake, I shall be satisfied with his likeness. This night shall close the door and put my anchor within the veil, and I shall go away in a sleep by 5 o'clock of the morning, which exactly fell out. Though he was very weak, he had often this expression, Oh, for arms to embrace him! Oh, for a well-tuned harp! He exhorted Dr. Colville, a man who complied with the prelacy afterward, to adhere to the government of the Church of Scotland and to the doctrines of the Covenant, and to have a care to feed the youth with sound knowledge. And the doctor being the professor of the new college, he told him that he heartily forgave him all the wrongs he had done him. He spake likewise of Mr. Honeyman, afterward Bishop Honeyman, who came to see him, saying, Tell the presbytery to answer for God and his cause and covenant, saying, The case is desperate. Let them be in their duty. Then, directing his speech to Mr. Colville and Mr. Honeyman, he said, Stick to it. You may think it an easy thing in me, a dying man, that I am now going out to the reach of all that men can do, but he before whom I stand knows I dare advise no colleague or brother to do what I would not cordially do myself upon all hazard. And as for the causes of God's wrath that men have now condemned, tell Mr. James Wood from me that I'd rather lay down my head on a scaffold and have it chopped off many times were it possible before I had passed from them. And then to Honeyman he said, Tell Mr. Wood, I heartily forgave him for all the wrongs he has done me, and desire him for me to declare himself the man that he is still for the government of the Church of Scotland. Afterwards, when some spoke to him of his former painfulness and faithfulness in the ministry, he said, I disclaim all that. The port that I would be at is redemption and forgiveness through his blood. Thou shalt show me the path of life, and thy sight is fullness of joy. There is nothing now betwixt me and the resurrection, but today thou shalt be with me in paradise. Mr. Blair, saying, Shall I praise the Lord for all the mercies he has done and is to do for you? He answered, Oh, for a well-tuned harp. To his child he said, I have again left you upon the Lord. It may be you will tell this to others, that the lines are fallen to me in pleasant places. I have got a goodly heritage. I bless the Lord that he gave me counsel. Thus by 5 o'clock in the morning, as he himself foretold, it was said unto him, Come up hither. And he gave up the ghost, and the renowned eagle took its flight unto the mountains of spices. In the aforesaid manner died the famous Mr. Rutherford, who may justly be accounted among the sufferers of that time, for surely he was a martyr both in his own design and resolution, and by the design and determination of men. Few men ever ran so long a race without cessation, so constantly, so unweariedly, and so unblamedly. Two things, rarely to be found in one man, were eminent in him, namely, a quick invention and sound judgment, and these accompanied with a homely but clear expression and graceful elocution, so that such as knew him best were in a strait whether to admire him most for his penetrating wit and sublime genius in the schools, and peculiar exactness in disputes and matters of controversy, or his familiar condescension in the pulpit, where he was one of the most moving and affectionate preachers in his time, or perhaps in any age of the Church. To sum up all in a word, he seems to be one of the most resplendent lights that ever arose in this horizon. In all his writings he breathes the true spirit of religion, but in his every way admirable letters he seems to have outdone himself, as well as everybody else, which, although jested on by the profane wits of this age because of some homely and familiar expressions in them, it must be owned by all who have any relish for true piety that they contain such sublime flights of devotion that they must at once ravish and edify every sober, serious, and understanding reader. Among the posthumous works of this laborious Mr. Rutherford are his letters, The Trial and Triumph of Faith, Christ Dying and Drawing of Sinners, and so forth, A Discourse on Prayer, all in octavo, a discourse on the covenant, on liberty of conscience, a survey of spiritual antichrist, a survey of antinomianism, Antichrist Stormed, and several other controverted pieces, such as Leray, The Due Right of Church Government, The Divine Right of Church Government, A Peaceable Plea for Presbytery, are for the most part in quarto, as also his Summary of Church Discipline and a Treatise on the Divine Influence of the Spirit. There are also a variety of sermons in print, some of which were preached before both Houses of Parliament in the years 1644 and 1645. He wrote also upon Providence, but this being in Latin is only in the hands of a few, as are also the greater part of his other works, being so seldom republished. There is also a volume of sermons, sacramental discourses, and so forth, which I have been desired to publish. An epitaph on his gravestone. What tongue, what pen, or skill of men can famous Rutherford commend? His learning justly raised his fame, true goodness did adorn his name. He did converse with things above, acquainted with Emmanuel's love. Most orthodox he was and found, and many errors did confound, for Zion's king and Zion's cause, and Scotland's covenanted laws. Most constantly he did contend, until his time was at an end. And at last he won to full fruition of that which he had been in vision. October 9th, 1735. This concludes Tape 7 of John Howley's Biographia Scoticana, or the Scots Worthies, the 1781 edition. This work is available from Stillwater's Revival Books, along with a treasure trove of the finest Protestant, Reformed, and Puritan literature available anywhere in the world today. Stillwater's may be reached at area code 780-450-3730 or be emailed at swrb@swrb.com. Stillwater's website is www.swrb.com and contains numerous free books and articles. Please note that these tapes are not copyrighted. We therefore encourage you to copy and distribute them to any and all you believe would be benefited. God's grace to you.